the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, one God, amen. I took a while in preparation, in preparing this slideshow that we have tonight. And as I was preparing it, I give the same talk to our three servants in our church a few weeks back. And I thought it's very important for all of us, not just as three servants, but also as servants and as priests. I felt that this was something of very important that we have to be in touch with. We have to understand. We have to have some kind of an idea of what these special needs are when we encounter them in our services. And this, by the way, doesn't have to be Sunday school service alone. It could be in our service at any capacity. If I'm serving a Sunday school class, or I'm serving in doing urban in the church, or I'm serving in cleaning the church, or I'm serving with young youth on a individual basis, you're going to see that this is something that we all need to have touch with. We all need to understand. And as I start talking about this, as I was preparing it, I felt that a lot of the issues that we are going to talk about tonight touched me personally. I felt that it hit home for me in some points that we're going to discuss tonight. And I just want to say that it might get emotional throughout the discussion. You might feel that this is something that you dealt with in the past. You might feel that it was something that you are suffering from, believe it or not. You might feel that this is something that you need to talk to your father in confession about, or you need to talk to someone about it. Before we could become good servants, we have to learn to be served correctly first. We have to be discipled. Before we could be good teachers, we have to learn to be good disciples first. Because if we're not good disciples, then we're never going to be good teachers. If we don't learn correctly, we're never going to be able to help others. And some of these points that we're going to be discussing tonight might, like I said, hit home for some of you guys. You might correlate with these points. You might feel that this is talking about me. And if it does, I would highly encourage you. If you need to talk to somebody, you need to talk to your father in confession, you need to talk to someone that you trust, you need to talk to a servant, you need to talk to a friend, someone that you really trust, we might need to do that. So we have to be healed first before we can heal others. We have to learn first, and like I said, we have to be discipled correctly before we could start teaching and helping others and serving others. Without being good disciples and healed, we're never going to be able to help others. So, special needs. First of all, I'm going to talk about, I broke it up in different parts. One of the first parts that I'm going to be talking about is how to help someone that's coping with terminal illness. This is a special need in our service. And like I said, it doesn't have to be, this might not be a Sunday school servant that's dealing with this. It could be anyone. You could be just visiting somebody in the hospital. By the way, I'm going to give this presentation to Tante Mary, and she'll maybe post it for you guys. So, like I said, this doesn't have to be a Sunday school class that you're teaching. It could be someone that you're visiting in the hospital. It could be a family member. It could be a friend. It could be someone that you know next door, neighbor. It could be anyone. So, dealing with and helping people that have terminal illness is very important for us to know how to deal with them. First of all, we have to let them know that you're willing to listen to his or her concerns, and never underestimate the value of your presence. Sometimes we are there and they're so quiet, and we're so quiet, we have nothing to discuss with them, and it feels so awkward to be standing there and they're in bed suffering. But believe it or not, just by you being there, it's very important to them. And it gives them a message that I do care about you and I'm here for you, even if you don't say anything. Just our mere presence next to them is very important. even if it feels if you're not doing anything or presence sends an important message, however, don't try to be a counselor. So don't try to say, oh, it's going to be okay. They don't want to hear that. Sometimes they need to vent out. Sometimes they need someone for them to listen to them. So sometimes this is all they need. Is there a typical emotional process that a person who has terminal illness experiences? So is there a process that they go through in their terminal illness emotionally? So dying, there isn't a science in dying. Each one experiences it differently. Each one's emotions are different. So, but don't assume that a person who has a terminal illness is going to go through this methodologic process of coming to terms with death. So it might not happen in a certain way. Okay, so each person is going to experience things differently. Learning to live as fully as possible while accepting the presence of a terminal illness is very important. So when a person that has terminal illness, they need to live a full life, like normal life. So they don't have to change anything in their life. And we have to give them that support. Like I said, I'm not just talking to Sunday school servants. I'm talking to a Christian individual. We are called to be servants as Christians. Maybe this group was picked especially to do something specific, but it doesn't have to be a Sunday school servant that's going to be doing the job. We are all expected to live this way, not just as a servant, as a Christian individual. This is the way that we're expected to live and to handle people around us. Do they have to accept that they have a terminal illness? Do they have to accept that they'll be dying before their expected time? Sometimes these people don't accept that they have terminal illness. We're going to see that sometimes it's very difficult on them to accept that they're dying. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to feel it. They feel that they're going to lose everything in life. They feel sometimes that they're going to lose everything they worked hard to earn in life. So it's very difficult for someone to accept dying in their heart and emotionally. How do you help someone who's in denial about his or her impending death? So someone that's saying, no, I'm not going to die. I've seen this so many times. I visit patients with cancer. And recently we had a mother that had two kids. And they were in high school. Both of them were in high school. And she had cancer. All of a sudden, within a month, it was metastasized to different places in her body. And it was stage 4. So there was no cure for her. There was nothing that they could do. All they could do is just put her in a hospice care. Hospice care is just give her painkillers and just make her comfortable while she's dying. So she is dying, but they're making her comfortable while she's dying. She refused to accept that she's dying. And she kept on saying, who is going to take care of my kids? I'm not dying. I know God is not going to take me away. I know God is not going to leave these kids orphans. So sometimes we have to deal with situations like this. And that's what this is concerning. Sometimes denial is very important in coping with dying itself. Sometimes we have to deny that I'm dying in order for me to let it sink in later on. So one of the processes of accepting dying is denial. This might be the first step. I'll deny it. Just like sometimes we take a test and you say, I got 10 out of 100. I studied. It was the teacher's fault. That's denial. And this is some way that we cope with our failure sometimes. And we blame sometimes others. But this is a way that we cope with our disappointments and failures in life, but this is much more than disappointment and failure. So this is death itself. They might be in denial because reality is too frightening, too overwhelming, too much of a threat to their sense of control. Sometimes these people, when they're sick like that, they lose control of their body movements. They need someone to help them. They need someone, believe it or not, sometimes they need somebody to change them and bathe them. They might be very young in age, but because of their diseases, they might need someone to assist them in everything, putting on their clothes, showering them, everything, just like a little baby. So this might be very humiliating for some people, and they don't want to accept it, so they deny. So like I said, denial is a form of natural protection that can allow them to let the reality in bit by bit and continue living his or her while contemplates on death. So this gives them a chance to think what's coming up in my life. As long as denial is not going to harm them, then it's fine. We could let them go through. It's not a problem. To provide emotional and spiritual support to them, invite them to talk about their fears. Sometimes, like I said, it's not easy letting out our fears. It's not easy for us to talk to somebody. It's very difficult to find someone that I could trust and talk about everything and just speak my heart out to them. It's not easy, especially when we deal with people and we lose trust in people. Sometimes it's very difficult to have trust in people once that happens. So let them talk. A lot of times it's easier for a dying person to share what he or she fears and explore it with someone other than their family, because sometimes it's hard and sharing this with the family, because they feel that the family is never going to understand what they're saying. They're never going to understand their feelings. They're never going to understand their emotional distress that they're going through. So it might be easier for them to speak to a servant or a priest. And sometimes, you as a servant, you might be there and you feel that they're talking and talking and talking, and you feel that they really need more help. They need someone now, maybe more than me. Maybe a priest that will take their confessions. Because, you know, as these people are dying, this might be the last chance for them to confess their sins. I visited someone that was dying, that came from Egypt. He had a stroke on a plane while he was traveling from Egypt to U.S. He had a stroke on the plane. And they landed in Kennedy Airport. They took him to the hospital. And he was dying in the hospital. I went that night that he came in. He confessed. The next morning I gave him communion. And a week later he died. And this was the only opportunity for him to reconcile with God. The only opportunity. If I wasn't there, if there wasn't a priest present, not me personally, but a priest to take their confessions and to talk to them. So then this is very important. What else can I do for a terminally ill individual? It's important to keep a vigil by someone when he or she is near death. This is very important for a dying individual. I remember, I don't know how many of you know Abuna Suriel mm-hmm. from Jersey City. Mm-hmm. I remember Abuna Suriel's memorial was last week, by the way. I remember being there. And I remember they had a big group of deacons and servants always present at his bedside. He had cancer. And there was a big group of servants and deacons always present at his bedside. Always saying the Psalms, praying the Psalms. Always praying the Tazbiha. Always reading the Bible. They've taken turns, but they're always there. A group would come maybe from the morning until the afternoon, and then another group would come in, and they keep a vigil by his bedside. This is very important, because the person that's going to meet with God, this is preparing the person spiritually and emotionally to meet with God. It's very important for them. And it shows that we care. It shows them that we care. What advice can I give to people who are grieving? This is something very important now. So now, I left the person that's terminally ill. I'm going to talk about the person that's grieving. It could be the person themselves, the person that's sick, or it could be the people around them that they're going through this grieving process. Grief is a natural response to loving and feeling loss that often comes in waves. So it's natural to grieve. There is nothing wrong with it. We see it in the Bible, in so many different situations. There was grief. It was mentioned in different places. Emotions can sometimes feel overwhelming, making even simple tasks difficult. Sometimes I feel so depressed that I don't want to eat. Sometimes I feel so depressed that I don't even want to do anything in life. I don't want to go to school. I don't want to talk to nobody. I just want to close my room and hang out by myself. I don't want to talk to no one. Even the simplest tasks that I might do without a problem, while I'm grieving, it's very difficult on me, on these individuals. This is normal. It doesn't mean that you won't be able to function for the rest of your life. Right now, you need to grieve. Keep in mind that grief doesn't necessarily begin when a loving one dies. So it could begin before that. We could, when we see our loved ones sick, a lot of times we grieve over them because we feel that we're going to lose them. So it's very difficult on us accepting that. And we start grieving. The grieving process can begin as a loved one's illness progresses or normal roles change. Like I said, these people sometimes might need someone to assist them in bathing, changing to clothes. Imagine you have someone in your household that's going through this. You have to feed them, and you have to bathe them, and you have to take them out to the doctor. They used to drive, now you have to drive them. So all these things, they make us grieve. If someone is unable to stop grieving and it's affecting their ability to function, then they may need professional help. Sometimes people go through depression when someone dies from their family, and sometimes they don't come out of depression for a long time. Individuals like this might need to be put on medications, or they might need to see a professional. So if you see that it's happening, that they're grieving and they're not overcoming it, then you need to let someone professional help and come into the picture. What do you tell people who are struggling with guilt? A lot of times when people die, I remember I had a brother that passed away about 12 years ago. And we used to be in one room together. Sometimes we would be sleeping at night. He would come back from work, and I have the lights on, and I'm reading a book or something, and he says, "Turn off the light." And I would say, "No, I didn't finish reading yet. I need to read." And then he would get upset at me and say, "I want to sleep." So I wouldn't turn off the light that night, for example. Sometimes he would ask me for a cup of water, and I would say, no, I'm tired, I'm not going to get you a cup of water. Sometimes he would ask me to run errands for him, and I would say, no, I can't do it. I have to go hang out with my friends. But guess what happened after he passed away? All these little things came back to my mind, and I felt so guilty for not getting him a cup of water that time that he asked me for a cup of water. I felt so guilty that I didn't turn off the lights that night that he was asking me to turn off the lights. I felt so guilty that I didn't get him the stuff that he needed when he asked me to get it for him. And we all go through this, by the way. Sometimes Satan allows it to happen more to others than the normal. He uses this to make you feel so guilty. And he uses this point to make other people feel so guilty that they didn't do enough to the person that was terminally ill or that was dying. Sometimes we feel that my parents, like these two kids that I told you about, their mom had cancer. These two kids in high school, they had so much guilt after their mother died because they felt every time that their mom was telling them, go to church, they said, no, I want to hang out with my friends. Go wear deacons. They said, no, I don't wear deacons. I don't like church people. I don't like deacons. They're double-faced. You don't see what they do outside on the street. You don't see how they talk. You don't see on their Facebook what they do. And after their mother died, they felt so guilty about everything that their mom asked them to do, and they didn't do it. So, guilt, sometimes, like we're going to see now, it's there, but sometimes it's exaggerated in certain people, and depending on situations and depending on the relationship that they have with each other. So after a loved one dies, people might question whether they did enough or said the right things. Guilt is normal, part of grieving. Often we come to peace and guilt gradually fades away. But sometimes, like I said, certain people live with guilt for the rest of their lives. That's not right though. They're not supposed to. They're not supposed to live with guilt for the rest of their lives. Even if we've done something wrong to our loved ones, it's okay, we make mistakes. It doesn't mean that we were the cause of their death. And that's why we don't have to feel guilt for the rest of our lives. It wasn't me that killed them. They passed away. Maybe I didn't say the right things at the right time. Maybe I didn't do the right things that I was supposed to do. But it's okay. It doesn't mean that I was the cause of their death. So we have to move on beyond this point of guilt. And it has to fade away eventually. And if it doesn't fade away, then they need to talk to somebody. If they're having trouble dealing with guilt, let them consider talking to a father of confession. Sometimes people would express their innermost feelings only to someone they are comfortable with. Like I said before, they might have committed a sin that they need to get out. Maybe they did something. I know I'm going to talk about abuse in a few minutes. I know a father that was abusive to his child, and his son died. And while his son laid in the coffin, he was praying and he was crying and he said, my dear son, I always told you how bad you were, and I always hurt your feelings, and I always told you you're a failure. I always told you that I was disappointed by you, but I never got the chance to tell you how much I loved you. So sometimes this guilt in us, we cannot deal with, and we have to open up with our father of confession, or they need someone that they need to express this openly, that they can trust. If someone loses a parent, one of the most important things is the feeling of emptiness, because if I lose a friend, it's not the same as losing a parent. A parent is everything to me. No matter how old I am, my mom and my dad is my mom and my dad. And that's how they feel about us. No matter how old we get, I'm called a child. When they address me, sometimes they call me my child, even though I'm abuna. They call me personally my child. So this is something that's not taken away from us at all. This is something that we experience and we live. And we feel that this is something, our life becomes empty a little bit if this happens to any of us. Mourning is how you express those feelings. You might plan a funeral or memorial service, wear black, and carry a somber demeanor. Both grief and mourning are natural and necessary parts of the healing process after a loss. So both grief and mourning. We could be sad and we could be crying. Expressing all of this, that's normal. That's normal and expected in the process of dealing with the situation. Acknowledge your pain. If you don't face your grief, your wounds might never quite go away. So that's the reason why I keep saying we have to talk about our feelings. And we have these people that are grieving, they have to talk about their feelings. They have to talk to somebody. If we don't talk, and if they don't talk, it's going to be inside of us, and it might hurt us more than it would help us. So allowing it in the open is much better to us. Accept that the pain you're feeling is part of dealing with grief and moving towards a state of healing and acceptance. So that's sometimes acceptable. This is okay when we're grieving and mourning. This is the process of healing. You know, when someone has an abscess, they have to cut it, and it's going to be very painful. But this is a process that we have to go through in order for the abscess to be healed. If it's not cut and open, then it's never going to be healed. And this is the same thing. We have this sadness in us. We have to express it verbally, physically, emotionally, in any way. And the more we express, the better it is for us. Look to loved ones and others for support. Spending some time alone is fine. A lot of times when an individual has someone that passed away, they don't want to be bothered by nobody. They feel that they lost the world. I remember when my brother died, I was still in college. And I was studying pharmacy. He was also a pharmacist. So when he died, my plans was to work with him in the pharmacy after I graduated. So as soon as he died, he passed away in August. August 27th. And my school was supposed to start September 7th. Like a week later. Or 2 weeks later. So a week later or 2 weeks later, I had no passion to do anything except grief and mourn over him. He was so loving. He was very close to the whole family. So at that point, I said, I'm not going to go to school no more. I was doing this to be with him. Now I lost him. Why do I need to go to school for? And I was so tempted to close up on the whole world and just be covert, just close up on myself. I don't want to deal with nobody. And that's the feelings that we get sometimes. And these individuals feel sometimes that they don't want to deal with you. When we even go to console them, they say, okay, thank you. I just want to be left alone now. I don't want to talk to nobody. I'm sure some of you have experienced this. When we go and console these individuals, they don't want anybody to talk to them. They just want to be quiet. They want to be in the rooms. They don't want anybody talking to them. This is fine, but isolation is not an issue. Is not acceptable. Isolation is sometimes a way to grieve about our lost ones. But if we live in isolation for the rest of our lives, then this is a problem. If these individuals live in isolation for the rest of their lives, then they're going to have severe depression. And they're going to have a lot of issues that they're going to suffer from eventually. And this is when we come in as servants. This is our role as servants. We have to intervene at this time and help them out. We have to be supportive to them. This is the time that they need us the most. Even though they might seem to reject us, but this is the time that we show our role as a servant, our patience, our love to them, and don't give up on them, because they really need you at that time. You see, people don't need us when they're in good health. They don't need us when they have peace in their heart. They don't need us when they're feeling good. But they need us as servants and as Christian supporters to them. When they feel down, when they're hurt, when they're wounded, when they have problems in their lives, that's the time that they need us the most. And this is one of the situations when they need us the most. So one of the things we sometimes, maybe in our culture, crying is a big issue. For a guy to cry, it's considered to be a shame in the culture that we come from. And it's sad that it's considered to be a shame. I've seen a father telling his maybe 9 years old kid, don't cry, be a man. Don't cry, be a man. Imagine when we instill in our kids that to be a man is you don't express your emotions. How sad that is. How much would this hurt this kid when he grows up to be a man, to be a husband or a father, and he can't express his feelings correctly. So crying is very important when we're sad. If we need to let a tear out, that's fine. It's okay. And we have to be supporting them while they do that. And we have to let them know it's okay to cry. It's all right. It's not a shame to tear or to cry or to be sad over your loved ones. Three more important points. I'm not going to read the description, but I'm going to go through the points itself. Don't make major decisions while grieving, because sometimes, like I said, when my brother died, I said I don't want to go to school no more. That was a major decision in my life. But I continued. I went to school anyway. And I said, I'm going to do it for him in his memory. So when I get my degree, I'm going to say that I got it in his memory, just for him, just to present something to him. And it made me so proud to do that. I felt that I had something to work on to make him proud of me. So don't make major decisions while you're grieving. And help these people not to make these decisions, major decisions while they're grieving. Grief consumes a significant amount of energy. A lot of times these people don't eat for days. If you see an individual that has someone that passed away in their family, they probably won't eat for days. And it consumes their energy. They feel down and they can't concentrate, they can't think correctly. So sometimes they help them to go to the gym, help them to take a walk, help them to eat, take them out to a diner, take them out to have anything. And this is important while grieving also. Remember that time helps, but it might not cure. So as we go, as time passes, it might help us. But if we have scars in us that we never expressed, it's never going to be cured. So the only way that anything is going to be cured is if I have to expose it in the open, and I have to talk about it. Sometimes, 7 emotional stages of grief. What happens to an individual that's grieving? I'm sorry I'm going in details in this discussion, because like I said in the beginning, I feel that this is one of the most important things for us as servants. When we deal with people, we're not just going to deal with people and tell them, you know, when someone is dying, we're not going to tell them, oh, the Bible says when you die, you go to heaven. But how about my emotions? Yeah, the Bible says I'm going to go to heaven, but my emotions are hurt. I'm grieving. I'm sad. What is the Bible going to teach me at this time? What benefit would the Bible offer me? I don't want to hear about the Bible. And this is the reason why, like I said, I'm sorry that I might be going in details about this issue. But I feel that as servants, we have to know how to deal with this situation. Because most of the times, the frontline individuals that will deal with these situations are servants, not anybody else. The servants are the ones that are going to deal with these situations much more than anyone else. Maybe sometimes more than the family. Because the family, I know a family that has one of the parents is sick, and the kids don't want to be home to see their parent bedridden, because they were used to this individual being so strong and running all over the place, taking them out. But now this person is bedridden. They don't want to even be home to help their parent that's sick. So that's why as servants we have to take that role sometimes. So what are the stages that we go through in emotional stages that we go through in grief? The first thing is shock and disbelief. And that's what happens when someone dies. We say, no way. I can't believe that my brother died. I can't believe that my mother died. And this is the shock that we get in the beginning. Or even a friend. Sometimes we have people in the church we might, today's Saturday, they might be attending Vespers, or they might be attending this meeting tonight, and then tomorrow, we hear that they passed away at midnight. And we come to church tomorrow and say, no way, he was just with me yesterday. We were just talking together yesterday. How could this happen? And this is the first emotional step that we go through. The shock and denial symptom. And then the second step is denial. So I might deny that my parent passed away. And then bargaining, I might say, okay, maybe they passed away, but I might be able to still be in contact with them somehow. I remember a lady in our church, her mother died. And she used to call her mom every single morning. The first thing she does, she would get up, maybe take a shower, make a cup of tea. She wasn't working. And she would get on the phone with her mom every single day. This was a routine thing. Every single day. Her mother passed away. In the middle of the day, they called me and they said that this person is hysterically crying and she is going crazy. And she's, in a way, hallucinating. She doesn't feel what she's saying. I went to visit them, and she said, I don't want anybody telling me my mother died. My mother didn't die. She didn't die. And then she said, who am I going to call in the morning? Tomorrow morning when I sleep tonight, and I get up in the morning, who am I going to call? I have nobody else to call. I'm not going to go to sleep. Don't tell me my mother died. So this was shock and denial to them. And then she started bargaining with me. She said, Can you just make God let me hear her voice one more time on the phone? That's all I want. I'll accept that she died, but just let me hear her voice one more time. And of course, can she do that? We can't do that. So she started bargaining with death. And then the next step is the feel of guilt. That we, like I said before, we might feel that we didn't do enough for them. We didn't say the right things. We didn't do the right things. And then we have anger and depression. Angry because we feel that we lost something very precious to us. And depression because we know that we can't live without it. So we seclude ourselves from the surroundings and from the environment and from society and everything. And then sometimes anger, by the way, is expressed more towards servants and the church and God. They are upset at God that they took their that God took their loved ones. They're upset at the servants because they don't understand what they're going through. We tell them, like I said a few minutes ago, we might tell them that their parents or their family member is living in heaven. But they say, yeah, it's okay, that's what you could say as a servant. That's what you're supposed to say. But you don't understand what I'm going through because you have your family member. You didn't have this experience that I'm having now. So sometimes they have anger towards servants, towards priests, towards God. And they sometimes blame God for taking away their loved ones. And then they start accepting and coping with the situation that they're in. So now they start realizing that this is the new norm for me. This is the normal life now that I have to live. And bit by bit, this is the process that we all go through. If someone is stuck at one point, then they need professional help. If you see them not progressing through this process, then they need professional help. Symptoms of grief can be emotional, physical, social, religious in nature. For children and adolescents, the reactions to death of loved ones usually reflects the particular development stages of the child or adolescent. Depending on when our loved ones or their loved ones passes away, it makes a big difference in their lives. One individual that had a tremendous blessing in his life, when his father and mother passed away as a child, does anyone know who?
Pope Shenouda.
Very good. Pope Shenouda. He lived as an orphan. All his life, from the moment of his birth, he was an orphan. But God blessed him so much because God says, I'm the father of orphans and widows. And he was so blessed by that in his life. And we see other individuals that go through this experience and it's a negative experience for them. So depending on when this experience happened in an individual's life, the outcome of it might be different. Okay, does anyone have any questions so far about what I spoke about? Because this is the second topic, and this is the last topic. I don't have a third topic. What time are we supposed to finish? No, I don't want to. I know I'm boring.
7:10.
Huh?
7 or 7:10.
7. Okay. Any questions so far? Anyone bored?
No.
Okay. The next issue that I'm going to be discussing might be more emotional than the previous one, and I think growing up in a Middle Eastern culture and background of our parents and the way that we grew up in Egypt, maybe not us personally, but most likely our parents. Growing up in that culture and environment, sometimes certain things are done and they're acceptable in that society and in that culture. And if it's not done, it's considered to be a shame. So if you don't hit your child, sometimes people, they consider it to be bad. You're spoiling your kid because you're not hitting them. So this might be something that I want to make sure that we understand that we don't want to blame our parents, we don't want to blame our caregivers, because this might be the only teaching that they had back home. This was the only thing that they knew better. This is the only thing they know how to do. But thank God for you guys and for U.S. servants. This would be something very important that for us to understand, and to understand when we're dealing with these individuals that have been hurt. We're going to see the abuse is not just physical, but I'm going to talk about different types of abuse. As servants, it's very important for us to recognize it and to know how to deal with it, because a lot of times the individuals, especially the younger kids, when they're abused, they might come to speak to, like I said, someone that they trust. And many times a servant is someone that's very trusted to these kids. And a servant has to know how to deal with them when they approach you. They have to understand what they're going through, what they're experiencing. You have to understand when they come and approach you, and how, and maybe they'll say certain words or certain things that might trigger in your mind as something wrong is happening. And so we have to understand that this is something that we have to be aware of as servants, because we might be the first, like I said, the front line to these individuals. They might not go to the police and complain. They might not go to the school and complain. They might not go to a lawyer and sue their parents for abusing them. They might not, right? They don't go to police or lawyers or anything. So they might not go nowhere. And they might just keep it inside of them. And they might continue to live life from stage to stage. And from them being abused, sometimes they turn out to be abusive as well. Sometimes, not all the times, because this is one of the myths that we have about abused children, that they were also abused. Or abused children will turn out to be abusive parents. That's not 100% right, as we're going to see now. So the first thing that I'm going to be discussing is child abuse is more than bruises or broken bones. While physical abuse is shocking to the scars it leaves, not all children, child abuse is as obvious. So we don't always see the child abuse physically in front of us. We might be abused inside of us. Some of us sitting tonight here might have gone through similar things that we're going to hear about tonight, and it might never show on us. And we might live life just as a normal person. But we have to understand that it's very important. Like I said, we have to be healed first before we could help somebody. We have to be we have to learn to deal with our wounds before we could help someone. You know, when I'm sure all of you have taken a plane at one point or another, they tell you when if something goes wrong and the pressure decreases in the cabin, what happens?
The masks pop down.
Thank you. The masks pop down. And these masks are what? They're oxygen masks, so we could breathe. Okay, they tell you something very important. They tell you if you have a child and you have an elderly person next to you, and you're in the middle, and you have three masks hanging up from the ceiling, which one are you going to put on first?
Yours.
Your mask first. Because guess what's going to happen if you don't put your mask on first? You might never have a chance to help that child or that elderly person that needs help. And that's why I say we have to be healed first from our wounds, to be able to help others. I have to put that mask on myself first. I have to understand that if I've gone or if I had that experience in my life, it's okay. It's not your fault. And it's not their fault that the person that's abused, it's not your fault that you were abused. Because somebody else made that mistake. You know, the abusive person was the one that made the mistake, not you. And this is something that we have to keep in mind for ourselves and when we serve as well with these individuals. Ignoring a child's needs, putting them in unsupervised, dangerous situations, or making a child feel worthless or stupid are also child abuse. I'm sure some people can relate to their parents calling them stupid at times, making them feel worthless sometimes, making them feel failure sometimes. And this is considered to be child abuse. Regardless of the type of child abuse, the result is serious emotional harm. And this is the most important thing that we're dealing with here. It might be physical, but the most crucial danger and hurt is the emotional aspect of it. So I have a few myths here about child abuse. So the first one, people might say it's only abuse if it's violence. So if I beat you up, that's only abuse. That's when it's considered abuse. Do you think that's right?
No.
So physical abuse is just one type of abuse. Neglect and emotional abuse can be just as damaging, and since they are more subtle, others are less likely to intervene. So second myth, only bad people abuse their children. Is that correct? No, even good people abuse their children. Sometimes people that come to church, they attend liturgy in the morning, they take communion, they go home, they might beat their kids at home after liturgy, Sunday. And the kids say to me, if this is what church people are doing, then I don't want to come to church no more. I don't want to belong to church. Because my parents, they come to church every Sunday, and they take communion, and they hang out with their friends, they look so good with their friends. But at the end of the day, they beat me up at home, or they emotionally hurt my feelings. So even good people abuse their children. The third myth is child abuse doesn't happen in good families. So these are families that maybe doctors, lawyers, educated individuals, people that have very high education. Child abuse doesn't only happen in poor families or bad neighborhoods. It crosses all racial, economical, and cultural lines. Sometimes families who seem to have it all from the outside are hiding a different story behind closed doors. And this is true with a lot of people. Fourth myth, most child abusers are strangers. And this is very, very scary, that we tend to think that a person that's going to abuse a person is going to be a stranger. While abuse by strangers does happen, most abusers are family members or other close to the family. And we're going to see that even in sexual abuse, it could be very close family members. Very close, and it's very sad. Sometimes we think the individuals that rape girls are just people that don't know them. but a lot of times it's people that are very close to the family. Fifth myth, abused children always grow up to be abusers. And like I just said a few minutes ago, this is not the story, because abused children might have gone through this process and feel so bad that they have gone through this, and they learn to heal. They learn to deal with themselves. They learn to cope with the situations. And they learn that this is not the way to bring up a healthy child. And they turn out to be wonderful parents and family members. So the first one that I'm going to talk about is the emotional abuse. Let's see if the computer doesn't turn off. Can you just exit? Thank you. One slide up. Okay. Emotional abuse can severely damage a child's mental health. That's emotional abuse. When we abuse them, or when a child is abused emotionally, their brain is going to be damaged. They're going to think in the wrong way. And social development, leaving lifelong psychological scores. People that are emotionally abused may never know how to deal with an individual the right way, because their brain is set up in a different way. They feel that, there was Abuna, the one that I serve with in the church. He was visiting a family, and he asked a little boy, "What's your name?" And then he, maybe 6 years old, and then he told them, "My name is Humar." Humar means donkey. Yeah. "My name is Humar." And then Abuna smiled at him and said, "What are you talking about? Humar, eh?" And then he said, "That's what my father called me all the time. Humar. Donkey." Because the father is making him feel stupid. That's what donkey means in Arabic. That's the notion of behind the word itself. That's what we mean by calling somebody like that. So the kid grows up to feel that he's stupid, and he believes that he's stupid. So growing up knowing that he's stupid, he's going to have lifelong psychological scars in his life. Everything he's going to do, he's going to feel that he's stupid, because that's what he grew up to believe in. So let's look at some examples of emotional abuse. Constant belittling. And like I keep saying, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt again before I read the slide. These are things that when we feel that the kids are telling us, those that we serve, these are things that would ring a bell in our minds, that this is emotional abuse. And these are things that we may have gone through ourselves. And these might be things that we have to be healed from in our personal lives. These are things that we might be suffering from. So, and it's okay, by the way, like I said, it's okay that we were dealt with incorrectly. You know, we're not gonna punish our parents, but at least we could be healed from it. We don't have to live that way for the rest of our lives. Knowing this and having our minds open and eyes open and understanding, this will help us to deal with the situation better for ourselves, first of all. So constant belittling, shaming, humiliating a child, calling names and making negative comparisons to others. Like sometimes we say, "Look at your friend, he always gets hundreds. You're always a failure in school. Look at your cousin, he's always passing classes and you're always failing. Look at how healthy he is. You never go to the gym." I know someone that was so much overweight. He was close to 400 pounds. And his father, as a teenager, would tell him, I guess my slide was done. The father would keep telling him, whose computer is this?
Anthony.
Can you move the mouse?
The battery is out.
I don't have an iPhone.
Oh, okay. Oh, I did a ball hole.
Nice question.
It's okay. No problem. I have a backup.
Thank you.
I'm back. Oh, يعني خلاص على كده؟ أنا ممكن أروح هنا على فكرة. I don't have to go on. If somebody pulled the wire by intention.
Emotional abuse.
Yeah, I'm getting that slide. Thank you. Thanks so much.
And to the pain.
Okay. So emotional abuse includes, like I said, it includes name calling and sometimes belittling. Like we tell them, you're worthless. Telling a child, sorry. Okay, so telling a child that they're no good, worthless, bad, or always making mistakes is emotional abuse. Always threatening and bullying them is emotional abuse. Sometimes the parents bully their kids to do certain things. That's emotional abuse. Ignoring or rejecting them, punishing in a bad way. Sometimes I know a story of a little child that took out her mom's beautiful dress, and the child had a little doll. And so the child looked at her mom's dress when she had it on, and she loved it so much. So she took out her mom's dress from the closet, and she tried to put it on her doll. And it was so big. She went and got the scissors. She got the scissors. And then she started cutting the dress. The dress was like $500 or something. She started cutting the dress to fit her doll. And then she did put it on her doll. She wrapped it around the doll. She went to show her parents. Her father, besides yelling at her, and correlates more with the physical abuse than the emotional. But it was so touching, both physical abuse and emotional abuse, that he hit the girl on her hand repeatedly until something happened with one of the fingers. They took her to the hospital, and she ended up having the finger amputated. So while the kid was in surgery, and after she came out of recovery, she was telling her dad and mom, "Mom and Dad, I'm going to save up and I'm going to get you a new dress, I promise. Can you put my finger back on? Can I have my finger again?" And this is, besides it being physical abuse, it's also emotional abuse, because this child has to live the rest of their lives with that hurt. Like I said in the beginning, we might all relate to what I'm saying right now. And it's not, I was close to crying, shedding a tear when I was preparing this, before, because I felt that this really touched me personally. So, like I said before, if any of you feel that this is something that you're suffering from, or has happened to you, it's okay to share it with someone that you trust.
poet.
Physical abuse involves physical harm or injury to a child. It may be the result of a deliberate attempt to hurt the child. So this might be a result of a deliberate attempt. So when they hit, they know they're going to scar the child. Sometimes people, believe it or not, family parents, they put needles on stoves. They heat them up and they poke their kids with it until they scar their hands. So this is physical abuse, and it's deliberate. They know that they're harming their kids. Sometimes people, they think that they're disciplining their kids by hitting them, but as we're going to see now, there is a difference between disciplining my child. Thank you. We missed you.
Sorry.
Please don't use the bathroom for the rest of the night.
Sorry.
You understand? It's not going to be abuse or anything, but you have to stay there anyway. Okay? Can you go down to slides, please?
Sure.
Thanks. Go down. So sometimes parents think that when they're physically punishing their kids, this is a type of discipline. But there's a huge difference between discipline and physically abusing them. When I break my child's finger, that's abuse. When I spank my child, that might be discipline. But there is the difference here is that this individual is deliberately hurting their child. Many physical abusive parents and caregivers insist that their actions are simply forms of discipline, ways to make children learn to behave. But there is a big difference between using physical punishment to discipline and physical abuse, like I said now. The point of disciplining children is to teach them right from wrong, not to make them live in fear. And this is a big difference between abuse and discipline. Abuse, can you turn the slide, please? In physical abuse, unlike physical form of discipline, the following elements are present. Number one, the abuse is unpredictable. I never know when this person is going to attack me. I never know when they're going to hit me. They might just snap at me in a matter of seconds, and they might hit me. The second thing is lashing out of anger. So they might talk to me in a low tone there right now, and then I'll say, "But Dad, I don't agree with you." And they say, "What do you mean you don't agree with me?" And then the next thing, a slap on my face. So this...
To make them agree.
The third thing is using fear to control behavior. You know, if you don't listen to me, what I'm going to do to you? I'm going to this and this and that. That's using fear to make them behave. Child sexual abuse now. So the first one, emotional. Second was physical. And the third one is sexual abuse. And this might be more closed up than any other form of abuse. This is something that's not out in the open as much. This is something that if somebody comes forward and talks about it, it's a shame for them to talk about it. This is what the culture teaches us. It's a shame for me to say, I was abused by my father. I was abused by my uncle. I was abused by my sister, my brother. And we're going to see that not just girls are sexually abused, but also guys are sexually abused. And it's unfortunate. Sexual child abuse is an especially complicated form of abuse because of its layer of guilt and shame. So I feel that I'm the one that caused it, so I feel the guilt on me. I feel that it was my fault because I was there and they did that to me. And I'm so ashamed of talking about it. It's important to recognize that sexual abuse doesn't always involve body contact. So I don't have to be physically in touch with an individual to be sexually abused. We're going to see now sexual abuse could be showing them a video, showing them a picture. That's a form of sexual abuse. Talking to them about certain things. That's sexual abuse. Exposing a child to sexual situations or material is sexually abusive, whether or not touching is involved. Sexual abuse, the problem of shame and guilt and sexual abuse, aside from the physical damage that sexual abuse can cause, the emotional component is powerful and far reaching than anything else in the sexual abuse. Sexually abused children are tormented by shame and guilt. They may feel that they are responsible for the abuse or somehow brought it upon themselves. This can lead to self-loathing and sexual problems as they grow older. Often, either excessive promiscuity or inability to have intimate relationship. I know a grandfather that had 4 grandkids. They were all girls. And he used to send his wife out. So he would sexually abuse the grandkids. One of them, I'm sorry to say this, but sometimes acts as a prostitute and is always looking for somebody to be with. And another person got married and she didn't allow her husband to touch her for 3 years of her fear of having a man touching her from what her grandfather did to her. She had to be treated. She went to the doctor and she had to be treated and she's fine now. But this is the extremes of sexual abuse. You can have an individual that's always looking for something like this because something was stimulated in them incorrectly, and you can have someone that's afraid of dealing with the situation. Okay. While news and stories of sexual predators are scary, what is even more frightening is that sexual abuse usually occurs at the hands of someone the child knows and should be able to trust. Most often, close relatives. And contrary to what many believe, it's not just girls who are at risk. Boys and girls both suffer from sexual abuse. In fact, sexual abuse of boys may be underreported due to the shame and stigma. So a lot of kids go through this and they don't come forward and talk about it. So we have to understand the servants. If something like this comes up in our service, when we're dealing with kids and we're dealing with individuals, even with our friends, we have to understand that they may say something that might trigger something in your mind to think about. And, okay. The shame of sexual abuse makes it very difficult for children to come forward. They may worry that others won't believe them. And this is something very important, by the way. Sometimes they think that nobody's going to believe them. Will be angry at them, or that it will split their families apart. Because of these difficult false accusations of sexual abuse are not common. So if a child confides in you, take him or her seriously, don't turn a blind eye. When someone comes to you and talks and says something, it took them so much to be able to say that to you. So don't turn a blind eye to them. You have to let them know that I'm listening to you. What else do you want to say? I had someone, a child, that came to me maybe a month ago. She was visiting Egypt. And she came and her mom told me that the girl was 6 years old or 7 years old. Maybe less than. She was in kindergarten, I think, or first grade. The mom said yesterday, this was a Saturday. So Friday night, the girl spoke to her mom and told her, I want to tell you something, but I don't want you to be mad at me. And she said, what? She said, while I was in Egypt, you were always telling me to sleep with grandmother. But grandma was making me upset. And you could imagine the rest. The girl felt so guilty. And she felt that she's going to cause a problem in the family if she talks up, if she speaks out. So this is something that we have to understand. when we deal with these individuals. Warning signs of emotional abuse in children. So this is the first thing that we spoke about. We spoke about emotional. What else?
Physical.
Physical?
Sexual.
And sexual. So let's talk about the emotional signs. How do I know that this person is going through emotional abuse? I'm almost done, by the way. Just maybe another 5 more minutes. Menu. What's more, menu?
Chris.
It's okay.
I'll be right back.
Okay, because I have something I have to give you at the end. I have something I have to give you at the end. I don't want you to miss out on
it. Yeah.
Excessively withdrawn, fearful, or anxious about doing something wrong. These individuals, you find them withdrawn from everything. They don't want to do anything. They don't want to participate. They don't want to talk because they might be looked at as stupid and ignorant. So they're so afraid and anxious of everything. And these individuals, you might find them sitting by themselves, not dealing with anyone or communicating or socializing. Shows extreme in behavior, either extremely confined or extremely demanding. Doesn't seem to be attached to the parent or caregiver. So they don't care about their parents. They don't want to be home, because they know when they're home, they're going to have an issue with their parents. Teddy, can you press it? Next one. Go on. Warning signs of physical abuse. So that's the first one, was emotional abuse. Those are the warning signs. Warning signs of physical abuse, frequent injuries or unexplained bruises or cuts, is always watchful and on alert, as if waiting for something bad to happen. You know, sometimes when you go like this to somebody and you see them moving backward, you know that they're afraid. They're going to get slapped in their face. This is something that they... Injuries appear to have patterns such as marks from a hand or belt. Shies away from touch. These people don't want to be touched because they're afraid. Flinches at sudden movements or seems afraid to go home. Wears inappropriate clothing to cover up injuries, such as long sleeve shirts on hot days. Warning signs of sexual abuse. By the way, when I say warning signs of all these things, I don't want you to look at individuals that have these things and you say, oh, now I know what this person is suffering from. This is just some common things, but it doesn't mean that if an individual is going through any of these things, then it must be sexual abuse or physical abuse or emotional abuse. Okay? So I don't want you to become doctors and diagnose them. This is just for us to look for in our services when we deal with these individuals. Trouble walking, this is sexual abuse. Trouble walking or sitting, because they might be touched in inappropriate ways. Displaying knowledge or interest in sexual acts inappropriate to his or her age, or even seductive behavior. Make strong efforts to avoid a specific person without an obvious reason. Like the girl that I was telling you, she was trying to avoid her grandmother. And the mother never knew why, but there was a reason that she was trying to avoid her. Doesn't want to change clothing in front of others or participate in physical activities. STD or pregnancy, especially under the age of 14, or runaways. So if a person is under the age of 14 and you see them pregnant, then you know for sure there's something wrong with them. If they have an STD, sexually transmitted disease, then you know there's something wrong. Or kids at a young age that run away from homes because they don't want to be bothered anymore. Dealing with abusive parents, I'm not going to read this, you're going to have it on the slide, but the first thing is encourage them to talk, encourage the kids to talk. Next slide. Number two, let them try to do whatever they can to prevent or avoid the abuse, or at least some of the biggest attacks. So find out what it is that makes their parents do that, and try to let them avoid these encounters with the abusive person. They should try to bite their tongue. This is during physical abuse now. This one is, you don't have to answer your parents back when they say something to you. Sometimes when you answer them back, it aggravates them more. So So sometimes this is what it takes until they are treated. So you let them know that, you know, when your parents are yelling at you, your father is yelling at you, you know, don't answer him back. Just be calm and be relaxed. Okay, next point. Help them tell their parents how they feel. Sometimes parents don't want to know how their kids feel because they feel that they're running the show, they know better, and they don't want their kids interfering with them. Next point. Direct them to move in a positive way. If they are unable to have a good conversation with their parents, and if they're able to talk to their parents, and they listen, they see that the parents are listening, then let them work on that. If it has a good outcome, then let them work on that. Next. Number six is direct and help them get some help from school guidance counselor, or therapy, or a priest. If the talking with the parents doesn't work, then this is the next step that the child needs to do. Help them get away from the abuse. So stay in a place that the abuse doesn't take place in. Okay, next one. They have to accept that while some families are functional, theirs is clearly not, and maybe never will be. So sometimes we have the kids, the person that's abused, they're very sad and they see all the other families, they have no problems. Why my family? Why me? So we have to let them know that, you know, it's sad, yeah, it's your family that's going through this, and it's you personally. But, you know, this is a problem that your family has, and we have to let them cope with that situation while getting them help. This is the last thing that we guide them with. Let them know that crying may never make their parents stop. Sometimes when we cry in front of our parents, sometimes this gives them a kick to do it again. This is what they want to see. They want to see their kids cry. So sometimes crying is not going to make them stop. I know a story of a girl that had gone through abuse from her father, and it was sexual abuse. And because the girl was so devastated through this, this was a shock to her. She was sleeping. She opened her eyes, and her father was there, abusing her. She couldn't bear the situation, and she felt that this was so tremendous on her, emotionally, physically, in every way. And the girl became blind from that point on. She lost her eye vision. She became blind because she couldn't bear to see her father doing this to her. And her visual abilities was gone. Tips for talking to these kids that are abused: avoid denial and remain calm. So if they come and tell you, my father did this to me, my brother did this to me, something happened to me, my father is always calling me stupid, my neighbors are always looking at me from the window, or anything like that. You know, don't deny what they're saying, but remain calm. Common reaction to news as unpleasant is shocking. This is very common. The first thing that happens to us is we're shocked. As soon as we're shocked, when someone gives us news, the first thing they do is they shut down. They won't talk anymore. So they don't want to talk to somebody that's going to be shocked. They want to talk to somebody that will listen to them and let them know that I'm hearing. Don't interrogate them. Let the child explain in his or her own words. Don't keep interrogating the kid, the individual. Don't keep asking them questions. Or, you know, we sometimes take psychology. Many of us take psychology in college. And we learn to ask open-ended questions and this and that. But this is not going to work here. These individuals, they just need you to be present there. Just listen to them. Let them put it in their own terms. And we have to reassure the kid, this individual, and the other things that we have to make sure that they're safe. So our interference in their lives, we want to make sure that the person that's causing the abuse is not going to harm them even more. You know, I'm not sure if you should see any shows on TV with these things about abuse. But I know people that abuse kids, if they are threatened, if the abusive person is threatened, they might end up hurting the child or the individual even more, even to the point of death. So we have to make sure that the first thing is that we have to make sure that they're safe. Our interference is not there to harm them even more. If we are not able to handle it, let someone professional handle it. But we are there to help them and assist them.